Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Kildare Focus. You're listening to KFM. It's Caoimhe Hearney with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Adele Coleman. She's a graduate attributes program manager at UCC, and she'll be giving us five skills that all new employees need. Then we'll speak to Cornelia Connolly. She's a computer engineer and lecturer at the School of Education at the University of Galway. The vast majority of those teaching new subjects, such as Leaving Cert Computer Science, are not accredited to do so. Then we'll speak to Dr. Tricia Keithley. She's Head of Social Justice and Policy at St. Vincent de Paul. Families whose children want to do transition year are paying anything from €100 to €900 just to register for the year. And then we'll speak to Melissa Hickey. She's a teacher at Skuldara Kilcock. The school has been reaping the rewards since a community dog named Vigo arrived on site in September. Of course, if you want to get in touch with any of the issues that we'll raise in the show, it's 045 898 999. If you want to email me, studio@kfmradio.com, or of course, you can send me a WhatsApp or a text.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, we live in an era where squiggly careers are the norm. So what are the important soft skills that employers are looking for? And what is a squiggly career? Well, I'm joined now on the line by Adele Coleman. She's a graduate attributes program manager at UCC. Good afternoon, Adele.
Hi, Caoimhe. How are you?
I'm great, Adele. Adele, tell us about squiggly careers and what that means.
So a squiggly career is essentially a career that means you kind of move frequently and fluidly between roles, industry, locations and careers. So I suppose in the past, sometimes when you embarked out on your career, you would have what's known as a lifer career. You might be in the same job for most of your life. But now what we're seeing is people moving between different roles. And it's also known as a happenstance career path, where different opportunities emerge that people with the amount of upskilling available can go for. So essentially it comes back to having really well-developed soft skills. So when you have lots of soft skills beyond your technical skills, you have that ability to be able to move a little bit more freely through different career paths. We're finding that somebody will change jobs up to 12 times in their lifetime now, and that is essentially what a squiggly career path is in a nutshell.
Okay, yeah. So back in the day, like you said, people might have just climbed the one ladder and went to the top maybe in that way. But now we see much more kind of a jumping from one career to the other. And like you said, the transferable skills from one career into another. According to this research that I'm seeing here, Adele, 85% of job success comes from having well-developed soft skills, which is a huge amount, isn't it?
It is incredible. It's a really huge amount, and we've really seen that, rise in the last 10 years or so. And the research that's coming out from research we've conducted here in UCC, as well as LinkedIn work and that of the World Economic Forum, is showing that having those well-developed skills really does set you up much better to deal with different challenges that the workplace can throw at you. So it really is huge. We were even quite shocked with those statistics ourselves.
And then the 15% of job success coming from technical skills and knowledge. So just explain to me the difference then between soft skills and hard skills, Adele.
So essentially your hard skills are your very technical skills. So for example, if you did an engineering degree, you have those key technical skills that are needed to be an engineer. But your soft skills are really a combination of your personal, your interpersonal skills and your personal career attributes. So things like having good communication skills, having good empathy, working well with people, having good organisational skills. So that's really the big difference. And we're seeing now in the workplace, any job spec that you look at, there's a huge focus on soft skills. And then they'll mention that you need to have a degree in a certain area. So it really is coming to the fore at the moment. It makes for a much, nicer work environment when you have a workforce of people who have key soft skills.
Okay, Adele, from the research that you've conducted along with your colleagues in UCC, you've identified five soft skills really that employers are looking for. Will you talk us through them, please?
Yes, so the first one really is communication. So communication skills are really some of the most valued skills in the workplace. So it's thought that the development of these skills is often overlooked in favour of the technical trainings, but workers who are more productive tend to have better communication skills. And that means that they can clearly express who, what, when, where, why and how of a project. So it comes back to being a good active listener, being able to gauge body language, thinking before you speak and really having good confidence in expressing yourself.
Okay.
Also, empathy is another key skill that's coming up. So it's being able to have a good emotional response, being able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. So if you're having a challenge in the workplace and or maybe working with a challenging colleague, it's important to be able to step back from the situation before you react and try to understand what might be going on for them.
Okay, it's very interesting. Definitely, it's something you hear a lot that communication is something that you need. But empathy, you know, maybe not as focused on as much in the workplace, Adele. The third one then, sustainable skills. What does that mean?
So having sustainable skills really comes back to looking at things like our action plans around the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And that's really becoming a key focus for many employers out there at the moment. So it needs what you need to do to be sustainable in the workplace is considering having good environmental awareness, but also being a good strategic thinker. So when embarking on a project, looking at a little bit more bigger picture, who can you bring into the fold? How can you work a bit more, better together? And having good creative problem-solving skills. And again, it comes back to that effective communication piece. So it's really about kind of looking at the broader picture and seeing what's the bigger societal impact of what you're doing in the workplace.
Okay, very interesting. Flexibility then, the fourth one, Adele, and I think it's something that both employers and employees are looking for within a role, isn't it?
It is, and sometimes you might see on a job specification, being flexible around your working hours in particular, but flexibility means much, much more. It's also really tied into resilience. So people who have that flexibility and resilience often have greater job satisfaction, work happiness, and do much better employee engagement. And it comes down to mindset. So you have a fixed mindset and a growth mindset. But in a fixed mindset, intelligence is kind of static. But with a growth mindset, that can really be developed. So having a growth mindset means being a bit more open-minded, seeing setbacks really as opportunities to build new skills and being much more open to criticism, but seeing it as something that you can work on when you do get that criticism. So it's a lot more than just, working beyond your 9-to-5.
Okay. Finally then, Adele, creativity. And it's something that unless maybe you're in that creative role, which I think many people will think, oh, well, sure, I'm a nurse. I don't need to be creative. But you're saying that it actually applies to every kind of career or job.
It can, definitely, because in every job and career, there's different challenges that you have to face. And, being a creative thinker will make you a better creative problem solver. So it's looking at how you can generate opportunities, particularly in fast-paced work places. So looking at how things maybe are done, and if you don't think that's satisfactory, then seeing how can you be a little bit more creative and change up a process to make it that little bit better. And we have found that in those creative workplaces where often employees are given, a little bit more rein to grow and be creative, that they're much more motivated and they have a much deeper sense of ownership over their work as well.
Adele, there's probably people listening in here and they've all the degrees in the world and they're overqualified probably for many of the roles that they go for, and their hard skills are probably second to none, but maybe they fall down on the soft skills. How would you say that they can improve them? Is it something that you can work on?
It's definitely something you can work on. There's always scope to develop out. This is as well as professional development, it's personal development. So not only is there a whole host of online resources freely available, so areas like Coursera, there's also, things like LinkedIn Learning. And beyond that, you can do more formal short courses in all of our higher education institutions on these different soft skills. But it comes too from, looking at yourself, having that piece of self-reflection and understanding what barriers might there be for you in developing those soft skills, and throwing yourselves into your hobbies, volunteering, getting involved in your community. All of these things can really help you to upskill in those areas of soft skills. And sometimes, I suppose, when you are in work, it's very focused, but you do have to take that time to self-reflect. And so many employers now are offering opportunities to upskill in different areas. So really keeping an eye on what's available and what's out there is really important.
Okay, that's brilliant, Adele. That is Adele Coleman, graduate Attributes Program Manager at UCC, with those five skills that all new employees need to get on in the workplace. And thanks very much to Adele Coleman.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, the vast majority of those teaching new subjects, such as Leaving Certificate Computer Science, are not accredited to do so. That's according to a new report. And I'm joined now on the line by Cornelia Connolly. She's a computer engineer and a lecturer at the School of Education at the University of Galway. Good afternoon, Cornelia.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Cornelia, can you tell us a little bit about this new report and the findings of it?
Yeah, so our report was looking at the computer science education landscape at primary and post-primary level in Ireland. We wanted to inquire of the capacity within the system, access to computer science, and also then participation in computer science education.
Okay. The findings, I suppose, may be surprising to some people, but given the shortage of teachers across the country, were you surprised by the findings, Cornelia?
Yeah, well, computer science is a relatively new subject in the at senior cycle level, so for Leaving Certificates level, and it's available in only 15% of the schools. And then corresponding to that, we have a very low number of teachers accredited to teach the subject as well. So there's lots of, you know, different variables that are playing into this these low numbers and low participation. But it's really about, I suppose, providing the students with the subject and making it accessible to all students. You know, that's what's really important, and not all students are getting the opportunity to study computer science within post-primary.
Yeah, I mean, 15% of schools, it's quite a low percentage, Cornelia, isn't it?
Yes, it is. What we found, you know, from talking to school principals and teachers, they really feel that other subjects are easier to implement. For example, like politics and society or education.
Sorry, Cornelia, also, your line seems to be a little bit weak there. If you don't mind just moving around slightly, you're kind of coming in and out, and then we'll test the line again. We might be able to hear you better. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sorry about that.
No problem.
Just 1 minute and I'll try and make sure it's better.
Yeah, no problem. I'll just read out some of the stats here. In terms of gender gaps emerging, 70% of Leaving Cert computer science students and 60% of junior cycle coding students were male. That's according to your report, Cornelia. Probably not surprising there, is it?
No, there's always been like a real like deficit in terms of female participation in computer science, but really there shouldn't be. And I suppose what we want to see is perhaps change in change so that computing and coding is introduced at a much younger age. If children are introduced to these concepts, then it'll be easier for them to study the subject at senior cycle or for their Leaving Certificate. It's currently very difficult for somebody, you know, to start a new subject after finishing junior cycle. So we can kind of understand why the numbers, the participation rates are so low. But European policy and other countries have introduced coding at primary school and indeed in preschool level too. So that would be an encouraging amendment if it could happen.
Yeah, it would be definitely great. The younger the better, because obviously it's something that we use all the time now and it's something that we need. The 34 accredited computer science teachers in the country, though, just coming back to that, like, what does it take for a computer science teacher to become accredited?
So in order to teach at post-primary level, one needs a qualification in teaching, in pedagogy. So that typically occurs through a two-year postgraduate master's in education. If someone's finished their Leaving Certificate, there are four-year degree initial teacher education programs which qualify them into teaching computer science and another subject. But one needs 60 credits in computer science along with their teaching qualification to teach at post-primary level.
Okay, so it just means that the other 106 computer science teachers out there do not have this master's in education then?
No. So what it means is that the other teachers are qualified or are registered in a different subject.
Right.
So
okay.
They're typically, for example, maths or science teachers. And so they are, most of they generally are registered teachers, but okay. not in computer science.
That's yet. Fair enough.
And they've all typically underwent in-service training with the Professional Development Service of Teachers, which is a terrific program, but it doesn't enable them to register on the Teaching Council register.
Okay, that makes sense then. And look, we hear that a lot here, Cornelia, anecdotally from teachers and, you know, students of and parents around Kildare where, you know, they might have someone teaching them home economics and they, you know, they're not actually a home economics teacher or that kind of thing. Obviously, a yeah. huge shortage of teachers at the moment. And we heard that news today that there will be over 600 extra teacher course places to come on stream over the next year. So at least that's something good there.
Welcome.
Yeah, in terms of then computer engineering and that kind of thing, computer science, what would you like to see happen? Because obviously this is your core subject, Cornelia.
Yeah, well, we really need, as I said, a holistic approach and a learning pathway from preschool to primary and into post-primary school and within initial teacher education so that all initial teachers people studying to become a teacher are exposed to computer science competencies. These are skills that that are really needed for the 21st century to understand how technology operates. When we think of emerging technologies like AI, robotics, automation, there's more and more software is becoming part of our life, and that's not going away. So computational thinking and coding, they're really important skills. They foster creative and original thought. And we need to make sure that our young people have the opportunity to be designers and makers and developers and not just consumers of technology.
Okay, that is Cornelia Connolly, computer engineer and lecturer at the School of Education at the University of Galway, with that news that the vast majority of those teaching new subjects, such as Leaving Certificate Computer Science, are not accredited to do so. Thanks very much to Cornelia. And like I said there, it does feed into what we already know, that there are a lot of teachers that are being tasked with teaching subjects that they didn't go to college for, they didn't study, because there is such a shortage of teachers. But hopefully that will change in the future. Now, families whose children want to do transition year are paying anything from €100 to €900 just to register for the year. And St. Vincent de Paul is saying that it is a huge roadblock and barrier for people from disadvantaged or lower income families in doing this year. And people should have access to the year if they want to do it. Now, I'm joined now on the line by Dr. Tricia Keithley. She's Head of Social Justice and Policy at St. Vincent de Paul. Good afternoon, Tricia.
Good afternoon.
Tricia, I remember back in the day when I did transition year, it was something that, I don't know if other schools did it, but you had to kind of get in, you know, you couldn't just do it. There was people who didn't get into transition year is what I'm saying. And I'm not sure if that's something that's done across the board, Tricia.
Yeah, I think it's evolved a lot over the last number of years. And I think really it's something that was seen as optional previously, but now a lot more students are opting for transition year. And I suppose our concern really is if costs are so high that it prohibits people in low-income families from participating, then, you know, that really creates barriers in terms of access and all the benefits of transition year. So at the same time, we also don't want parents to be put under so much pressure that they can't afford it, and then their kids aren't getting the benefit of it either. So really, you know, transition year has a whole range of benefits, but it's really important that everybody who wants to access it can. And cost isn't a barrier.
Of course. My own little brother is actually in transition year at the moment. And like that, you know, there's different school trips and €500 for this and, you know, different prices. And like, it is quite costly. But I wonder, like, it is the parents footing the bill. So how would somebody from a lower income family actually participate in transition year and be able to go on all of these trips if they're not getting, the school isn't providing the funding or the funding isn't coming from the government, Tricia?
Yeah, that's right. I suppose that's the real concern. And I suppose it really does vary from school to school in terms of what the programme consists of and how many trips there are and whether there's a, you know, trips in Ireland or abroad, you know. And I suppose what we would be saying to schools really is look at all the programme activities that you're planning for the transition year and assess them to say, look, there's all these benefits, but really against the cost, is it worth it? And for students who may not be able to participate, is there an alternative that everybody can access? So it's really important to think about how the transition year programme may impact on students who may not be able to participate in everything and making sure that it really is inclusive. Because, you know, there obviously is really important things that you can be doing in transition year, whether that's, you know, volunteering or, you know, taking part in different kind of courses or different kind of subjects or engaging with your community that costs very little but have huge benefits for students as well. And of course, like, cultural trips are really important as well. So we'd be saying, look, is there a payment plan that parents can avail of for those kind of things if they are struggling, or could they maybe have waivers? And I suppose what we'd be saying as well, you know, the Department of Education could look at having a grant that would facilitate participation for students who are maybe in lower income families as well. Because, as you said, you know, if you can't access that or you feel like you're not going to be able to participate fully, you're probably more likely then to just go straight into fifth year. Yeah. And, you know, we know research shows that there's so much you can benefit from transition year, like engaging in volunteering, like doing all the different types of activities that you wouldn't normally do in school. So we don't want students to lose out on that just because of money.
Absolutely. And in terms of younger children as well, like, there's some people who, you know, depending on the time of year you're born, you could be going in to fifth year and you're only 15 or just gone, you know, maybe just gone 16, which is quite young. And then you end up maybe doing the Leaving Cert then and you're only 17. And for some students, that's probably not their choice. But like you said, the access to transition year, whether that be in terms of money or like that in many schools I know across Kildare, the fact that getting into transition year is actually based on school performance and how good, and, you know, if I say that in quotation marks, you are actually in school.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, you know, there's loads of different factors. And again, it's just the variance across schools in terms of how they run their transition year programme. But you're absolutely right. You know, if you're going into the senior cycle and the Leaving Cert and all the stress that goes along with that, you need to be mature enough and have all the skills that you need to be actually to cope with that. So transition year is a really good opportunity for students to kind of take that pause and really prepare then for going into senior cycle as well. So, you know, there's a whole range of different issues, and I suppose, you know, it's really not fair that people couldn't access that because of money as well. So we'd be saying to schools, you know, is there ways you could spread out the cost throughout the year? And as I said, things like waivers or payment plans for people who may not be able to pay up front for things as well is really important.
Mm-hmm. Is this something you've heard in St. Vincent de Paul where parents can't allow their child to do transition year because of money?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt, you know, that wouldn't be an option for many young people who come from low income families, and they do go into straight into fifth year. Now, there's loads of other reasons where people don't want to do transition year, and it's not just financial. But yes, absolutely, we would hear from families who said, look, it's just not an option for our family. We can't cope with the extra costs that go along with it, and they're preparing then for fifth and sixth year, which can also be really expensive for families when you think about mock fees and exam papers and all the things that go along with that as well. So, you know, there's a huge amount of pressure on families around back to school costs. And I suppose our overall aim in St. Vincent de Paul, you know, is to make primary and secondary school genuinely free for all students. You know, we've seen progress there. They're introducing the free school books at primary level, you know, and we'd really like to see that extended across secondary school as well. We think that could make a big difference. But there's a whole range of costs. But transition year is coming up more and more now for families. who just can't meet the very large sums of money being requested sometimes by schools.
Okay, that is Dr. Tricia Keelty there, Head of Social Policy and St. Vincent de Paul, with that news that there are families whose children want to do transition year, but they maybe can't afford it because sometimes it can cost up to €900 just to register for the year. And thanks very much to Tricia for your time. I'd like to know from anyone in Kildare, you know, if your children have done transition year, how expensive was it? Did you find it very expensive? Maybe you couldn't let your child do transition year because you couldn't afford it at the time. 0833 97 97 97. Like I said, I did actually have a friend, still a very good friend of mine, didn't get into transition year because, you know, I suppose she was young and she maybe acted the maggot a bit, but she was quite young going into fifth year then. Her mother actually pulled her out of the school, sent her somewhere else, and then eventually the school took her back in and allowed her to do fourth year. But it's something that needs to be looked at as well, I think, that, you know, many children don't actually get in to fourth year, let alone have the money to do it. So it's something else that schools need to think about there too. Now, a secondary school in Kildare has been reaping the rewards since a community dog named Vigo arrived on site in September. And I'm joined now on the line by Melissa Hickey. She's a teacher at Skuldara in Kilcock. Good afternoon, Melissa.
Hi, Creeper. How are you?
I'm great, Melissa. Tell us about this dog, Vigo, and why is he so good?
Right. Well, Vigo, you know what? He's a mascot for the school. He is the best dog ever. He's fully trained. He was trained as if he was going to be an Irish guide dog, but for whatever reason, he didn't get there in the end. So he was put as part of a school community program, school dog community program.
Okay.
We were so lucky to be able to get him. The waiting list is huge for these dogs. But we were able to get him through my PY students because they were interested in it, and they did it as part of the Young Social Innovators project last year. And he works with students who have extra needs, who have anxiety, who have had a terrible day. I've seen him alleviate a stressful classroom. He's allowed to walk around the class if everything's okay with him off leave. He has a bed in my room. He is in the vice principal's office most. She is his first handler. And like the other day, I saw a student, she had a terrible day. She got to spend time with Claudia Ward, deputy principal, and Vigo, the dog, in the office. She came out able to face the day after. She got Vigo cuddles and she was able to groom him and everything. And he, you know what? He's able to sense when people are down and he just goes over and lies at your feet. And it just makes it a huge difference. His body language and everything, just like he lights up a hall when he's walking by with his handlers. Mm. You know? He's great.
But that's the thing about dogs, Melissa, that, you know, they have an ability, like a sixth sense, to be able to know, like, when you're sad or when you're down. We always talk about it in here in the mornings because most people in here have dogs. Like, it doesn't matter what happens in work or in school, you know, a dog doesn't care. You know, a dog doesn't care how much money you have or, you know, what job you do, or they just want to be given love and attention, don't they?
Yeah. And oh God, is he loved in school. Everybody loves him. He's a conversation starter as well. You know, it's easy to talk to the students along the corridor and stuff, and he's with you. They come straight over and ask him, they pet him. He's an icebreaker. Like, he really does change the hallway as he's walking by. Like, everybody's like, oh, Vigo, and everything when they're going by. And they ask and they pet him and everything. You know, he's a great asset to our school.
And tell me this, Melissa, does he just kind of roam around the school at will? Or?
No, not at all. He has three handlers. Clodagh is his main handler. She's the vice principal, as I said. Myself, I'm the second handler. And Claire Kenny, the head of SEN, is the third handler. And he comes into certain classes, so he might come into like a 6-year math class or whatever with me, and okay, you can imagine what they're like at the moment after the mocks and everything. There's lots of stress.
Especially
in there.
Maths.
So we're like, yeah, absolutely. I've seen him go over work as magic and like lie down on people's feet. He goes around with Clodagh. He's always on leave. But like if we go into the class, we will say, is everybody okay with dogs here? And if they're okay with dogs, then we can let him off as long as the door shuts. So he's not roaming free or anything.
Okay.
He gets his downtime. He gets his rest time in Clodagh's office. He has a bed in the tree handler's room. So, you know, he does have lots of rest breaks in there as well as doing his job.
Yeah, because that's what I was my next question was going to be. When I was younger, I was quite scared of dogs. So I imagine that, you know, there might be some students who are scared of dogs too in your school. How do they deal with him, or have they kind of come around to dogs more now that Vigo is around the school?
Well, had a first year now that was absolutely terrified of dogs. But last week, after seeing him on his lead and everything walking around school, she asked me, could she come in to meet him properly with myself and Clodagh?
Okay.
So this is somebody that was terrified. So she's going to go in and meet up with him. You know, we will keep him over the other side of the room until she's happy and comfortable. We'll have him on lead when she wants to actually pet him, if she does or not. But we might even just try and build up a relationship between them, like, slowly over time. If you don't like dogs, like, you don't have to go away. He's not, like, roaming corridors all day, every day or anything, you know. You can avoid him if you don't want to see him. But most students are completely positive about him being there.
I can imagine there's great sense of pride around Vigo. And how old is Vigo?
He was 2 on December the 12th there. He has the best personality. Like, he definitely has a personality made for teenagers and our school. Like, he just fits right in. He does. He's a Golden Labrador Retriever mix. He's just a bundle of energy, but then he can be so loving and quiet and calm as well. So he's great.
Oh, that's brilliant. And I suppose, you know, would you recommend other schools to go about maybe trying to get their own dog? Is it a tough process?
Yeah. So do you want to hear how it came about? Or?
Yeah, please tell me.
So during COVID, it must be 3 years ago now to say, my transition year student weren't allowed to do any trips or workshops. Or, you know, when we went back in and we had to do the 2 metre distance and everything. So morale was very, very low. And we decided to do a dogs and puppy farms for our young social innovator project. We started getting working pups in and dogs into the school. And then we came across, at the end of the year, I think it was April, Donica and Travis. Travis was the first guide dog to actually do the school community dog project. And he's in Dunboyne School in Meath. And he came in with his owner and we learned all our information from them. So then we decided, with my last year's transition years, to go ahead and try to pursue Irish guide dogs. But like, there's a massive waiting list for it and everything. But I think it's because my students are the ones that pursued it. They asked the board of management. They got in contact with Irish Guide Dogs. They took it upon themselves to do this. They got noticed because of it. And they got rewarded in the end after a whole year.
Yeah, that's amazing. And look, I can't believe, like, a dog in a school, it must be just so nice for students to come in, have that there, like you said, if they want to. But of course, they don't have to talk to him if they don't want to. Is there an outdoor area for Vigo? Like, is it kind of secured outside the school?
We're lucky. We have fence and gates and everything all around our school. He has his own area where he goes out to have his own little breaks, and that's fenced off for him. So that nobody stands in any, any of his poops or anything. But he has his own area. He's very happy. He's plenty. I had to bring him out along the canal and everything during my classes off, and he's so great. Even when I go into Clodagh in the office to talk to her, but even if I've had a bad day, he really just brightens up my life, actually. It's just brilliant.
I can imagine. And listen, it sounds like Vico is the luckiest dog in Kildare, because I'm sure, how many students are in Scoldara? Probably a couple of hundred.
930.
So he has up on 1,000 people then, between teachers and everyone else loving him every day of the week. So I'm sure Vigo is very well looked after. Well, listen, Melissa, thanks very much. That's Melissa Hickey. She's a teacher over in Scoldara in Kilcock, telling us about Vigo, the community dog who is roaming the corridor is over there, but not on his own. He does be on a lead and brought around, and he has an outdoor area as well. So it's brilliant over there for everyone in Scoldara. Now, I'm nearly up on time here, but I have to say one quick shout out before I go to the gang out in Cara listening in, Bernadine, Ross and Emer, and of course Karen, who is out there in Naas as well. Emer McCabe travelling back to Vancouver tomorrow, and she wants to say a very big shout out to all of her family. She says she loves them so much and she's going to miss them so much, but she's always only a call away, and I'm sure they will be over to see her in Vancouver very, very shortly. That's all we have time for today. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow between 2 and 3.